You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. For the rest of the hour, a look at bats. Yeah, bats. B-A-T-S. Aside from snakes, there is probably no animal that is more misunderstood and feared than the bat. And most of what immediately comes to mind about the bats is probably wrong. They all suck blood, right? Wrong. The overwhelming majority don't suck blood. They are as blind as a bat, right? Wrong again. Bats aren't blind, and they don't turn into Dracula even today on Halloween. Over 1,000 species of bats exist around the world, ranging from as little as 2 grams with a 4-inch wingspan to over 2 pounds with a 6-foot wingspan. About 45 species of bats are known to live here in the United States. Some are solitary or live in small groups. Others gather in colonies that can number in the millions and have a significant impact on the local ecosystem. So don't touch that dial. We're off to the bat cave, figuratively speaking. If you want to ask and share your knowledge about bats, give us a call. Our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-8255. We will not be talking about Dracula this hour, so let's take that right off the menu at this point. William Gannon is the Senior Collection Manager and a Research Associate Professor at the Museum of Southwestern Biology at the University of New Mexico in Albuquerque. He joins us from KUNM. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Gannon.
Oh, thanks, Ivan. Nice to hear you.
Thank you. Thomas Kuhns is a Professor of Biology and Director of the Center for Ecology and Conservation Biology at Boston University. He joins us from the studios of WBUR in Boston. Thank you for being with us, Dr. Kuhns.
Thank you, Ira.
Can you tell us about how many kinds of bats, Dr. Kuhns, there are? How many worldwide, do you think?
Well, the best estimate we have right now is about 1,100 plus or minus a few. That's the latest count.
Wow.
And bats occur everywhere from, live on every continent except Antarctica. So they're pretty widespread and highly diverse.
And I started out by naming some of the common misconceptions that people have about bats. Give me a few more of them.
Well, one of the perceptions that they get in your hair, and I think that's probably sometimes a bat may have gotten in somebody's hair, but that's not a very frequent occurrence. It's maybe I think the myth of that may have started back in medieval times when women used to wear their hair up in a big pompadour and probably didn't wash their hair for weeks on end and may have attracted insects, and perhaps a bat came by and happened to get snagged in the hair. But we have no evidence in current present time that bats really go for people's head, although there are bats that are attracted to insects and certainly seek out insects as prey, and oftentimes insects do fly around people. So they may think they're coming close to them, and at least they appear to be coming close, and people then make that leap of faith to think that they're actually going to get into their hair. That's, I think, what you've already said is that the myths of them sucking blood and so on is there are the common ones.
Bill Gannon, New Mexico has a very high diversity of bats, does it not?
Yeah, we have about 27 different species of bats, and that's actually another one of those misconceptions. Maybe is that I often have people say, "Well, there ain't bats around here," and quite often there's 4 or 5 species that are urban bats, and they're out and about at night above your house.
Above your house? Can you confuse them with a bird? I mean, sometimes at dusk I'm saying, is that a bat or is that a bird? How do you tell one from the other?
Well, if you get a good shot at them visually, you can tell by their flight. Most bats have kind of an erratic flight as they're flying away from you. And and birds are, they're on their way home. They're going to go hunker down for nighttime.
Let's talk about where bats live. Thomas Kuhns, do all bats live in colonies? You see these giant... I once was in a bat cave in Puerto Rico. There were 100,000 bats in this cave. Do they all live like that in big colonies?
No, they don't. In fact, probably a good number of bats are solitary or live in very small groups that most people would never see. We hear about the bats that live in large caves, and because partly we can see them. I mean, Carlsbad Cavern is one, is a national park that people go visit and see these large numbers, and there are others like in parts of Texas that form large colonies. The Congress Avenue Bridge in Texas, for example, in Austin, is a very large attraction. It's visitors who come to the city see these large numbers. But for the most part, bats are very secretive, and people often don't even know if they're living in their house. They may, or living outside their house under shutters. People often don't even know they exist until you point it out to them.
And what do bats eat? I mean, I know they're very good at mosquitoes. Is that correct?
Well, actually, that's ironically probably a mistruth. Mm-hmm. It's not, they do eat insects, and there are not very many bats that actually specialize on insects. Some of the very small ones, like the one that you mentioned earlier, the two-grammer,
right.
Does feed on mosquitoes and so on. But for the most part, bats are very insectivorous. Bats are very generalist. But there are many other kinds of dietary habits. I mean, some eat and specialize on fruit. Some feed on nectar and pollen. There are also carnivorous bats. There are a few bats that feed on fish. And so, of the carnivorous bats, there are ones that actually feed on frogs and lizards and sometimes even other bats. So they have a very wide range of dietary habits. But, you know, each individual species is relatively specialized.
And so do you want bats living near your house? Because people are afraid that you get these solitary bats under the shingles or whatever. They're afraid of those. Are bats something you want to be around? Do they do good things for you?
Well, they do. And I think if we consider that insects, whether they're mosquitoes or sometimes crop pests, they are just pesky little insects flying around and getting into your hair and in your eyes and so on, in your ears in the summertime, bats do provide an important service. And one of the really hot topics today in ecology is trying to understand the services that bats provide for humankind. That is, that many bats, for example, feed on insects that are pests of garden crops and also major agricultural crops. So they do provide an important service, and we have to recognize them for that. On the other hand, there are pollinators. For example, in the southwestern United States where Bill lives, there are bats that pollinate flowers, cactus flowers, and agave, the plant that is an important species for which the distillate from which tequila is made. So there are also tropical species that pollinate but also disperse seeds and help maintain the diversity of forests. So they're, depending upon the kind of dietary habits they have, they have different functions in ecosystems.
Mm-hmm. And let's get right to the crux of this whole vampire bat stuff. Any vampire bats in the United States? Bill?
Well, actually, there's three vampire bats that are recognized, and they're all, and Tom will want to add to this, I'm sure, but they're all Western Hemisphere species. There's one here that comes into southern Texas just a bit. Diphylla is the genus name. It's commonly called the hairy-legged vampire bat. There's three species, like I said. The common vampire that you've probably heard about feeds on cattle, usually in the more tropical regions of Mexico and such. Diphylla, the one that comes here in the United States, feeds on primarily on chickens, maybe other birds as well, but at least in captivity they're fed well on chickens. So one of the interesting things about Diphylla is some of the other two species of vampire bats have sort of a lapping way of collecting the blood into their mouth and eventually into their gut. Diphylla has a way of perhaps forming a seal over the nick that it's made in its victim's skin, and literally maybe sucking blood. You said you didn't want to talk about Dracula.
Well,
it's almost Dracula style.
Let's go to the phones. 1-800-989-8255. Ramey in Fairbanks, Alaska. Hi, Ramey.
Yeah. Well, how about that? Two calls from Fairbanks in one show here. Question about what do bats do in the winter? I've seen bats up here as I sit out on a bonfire in the summers in the evenings, but then where do they go in the winter? Do they migrate? Do they find caves and overwinter?
It depends on the species. There are some bats that hibernate in caves and rock crevices, and others migrate. And in Alaska, there are certainly places where they potentially could hibernate in rock crevices. There are also species known from at least southern Alaska where that they do migrate. So it depends a great deal on the species. You have a common little brown bat that occurs in the southern part of Alaska, and they are known to hibernate. And they basically hibernate for anywhere between 7 to 8 months a year. And during the summer, they're out feeding.
And then how far could they migrate to find a place to hibernate, rather?
Oh, they can go hundreds of miles. Actually, the little brown bat, there are records of at least 300-mile migrations based on individuals that have been marked with little bands, that the sort of traditional way of marking.
Thanks for calling, Ramey.
Well, thank you.
One of the most fascinating things I was reading about bats is that I had been in a cave with, I'd say, maybe 100,000, but there are caves where there are a million bats in them. And they go out, as you say, and they go out at night, and they feed at night and come back. How do they know where to go in that cave with their own offspring, or, you know, finding their own family? How do they do that with a million bats in a cave? Do we have any idea?
Well, we actually do. A colleague of Bill's and mine by the name of Gary McCracken, who is from the University of Tennessee, actually asked that question several years ago discovered some very fascinating things. One is the sensory modalities of bats are really not much any different than humans and other mammals. They use olfaction, they use vision, they use spatial memory, and it turns out that in the order of spatial memory to vocalizations to olfaction is how they actually find their young. I mean, some of these caves, these large caves that you were talking about, have up to 10 million or more bats in them. And as the question arises, well, how does a mother possibly find her little baby in that cave? Well, they roost in relatively specific areas in a cave. So if they're off in the left corner or the right corner or deep in the cave somewhere, and so they have learned they've memorized where they've gone, and so once they're in the cave, all these little babies are calling what is called infant calls. These are calls like saying, "Mommy, feed me, feed me." And so mothers will eventually go to this place that is they've remembered from being there before, and then they listen to these calls. Now, babies tend to have, and many animals have, unique vocal signatures. And so the mother will land on this place where all these little babies, it's called a creche, where the babies are left, and will crawl around listening for her baby's call, and eventually get within just a few centimeters of where her baby might be, and may find it difficult to discriminate her baby's odor, or her baby's vocal signature from another one that is nearby. And so the final decision that she makes as to which one is her own infant is based on olfaction, how the baby smells. And there are also very distinct olfactory signatures as well.
Fascinating, because I guess being a mother bat is a full-time job. We're talking about bats this hour and Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. In fact, the mothers and their young are very close for a long time, are they not? In bats?
Well, they're close in the sense that the mothers nurse their babies for a relatively prolonged time. And it depends on the size of the bat, the species. There are some that nurse their babies for only about 4 to 5 weeks. Others can nurse them up to 6 months. It just depends. Usually the larger ones have a longer period of lactation. But one of the fascinating things about bats is that they're only mammals, the only mammals that where the mothers nurse their babies until they're almost adult size, like the size of a teenager human. And this is pretty fascinating. But and the reason for that is young bats can't fly until they've almost reach adult size. Hmm. So the only way they can get food is from their mother's milk.
Hmm. And they get the car keys. 1-800-989-8255. Bill Gannon, we're talking about one of the most fascinating things about bats is what we call echolocation. How do they send out these sort of sonar signals? And I know that you have collected them and given some of them to us.
That's right. Actually, I think you took them.
We took them. You weren't looking. You weren't looking on the internet. and there's something called Anabat. Is that the system you use, a recording device called Anabat?
Yeah, as Tom mentioned, that bats echolocate and produce calls for various uses, and bats, like all other mammals, have a call repertoire. We focus in on the calls that bats make when they're flying around, commuting or foraging, or just trying to orient themselves at night, and record these calls and place them on a library on a website for other people to use and examine.
That's where we stole them from.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Let's play them now, because it's amazing the distinction between the different kinds of bats. Let's go to, here's the big brown bat. Now, there's nothing wrong with your radio. I can see radio technicians all over the country saying, uh-oh, I'm getting digital effect artifacts. Let's go. Okay, the Mexican free-tail bat, also the Brazilian tree bat.
Free-tail
bat. Wow. The pallid bat. You don't want to listen to these with your headphones on.
I'm moving my headphones.
the silver tail bat. So. Wow. And the southern yellow bat is our last one. That's amazing.
Ira, it's important to note, and I think Bill could comment on this too, that what you're hearing is the audible, it's a sound. These bats are producing sounds normally well above the ability for humans to hear, and the Anabat detector actually reduces that sound to an audible sound that we can hear there. But for the most part, humans can't hear anything above about 20 kilohertz or 20,000 cycles per second. And many of these bats are producing sounds up to 100 or even more kilohertz, down in the range down to 20 kilohertz. The few, occasionally people can hear audible sounds of bats as they're flying, and those are bats where that sound that sweeps down through several to frequencies down to the audible sound, then people can hear. But the sounds that we hear in a cave, for example, where the mother is trying to locate her young, those are generally audible sounds. And if you ever walk into a cave when babies are crying, or even mothers are screeching and communicating, communication versus echolocation calls are actually quite different. Mm-hmm. But yet they sort of phases into the other.
All right, we're going to take a short break. Come back and answer lots more of your questions about bats. Maybe you have a bat story or so you want to share with us. Stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flato. We're talking about bats this hour with my Batman guest, William Gannon of the University of New Mexico in Albuquerque, and Thomas Kuhns at Boston University. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Lots of people want to talk about bats, and let's go to talk to Chip in St. Augustine. Hi, Chip.
Hey, how are you guys doing?
Hi there.
I used to live in Tallahassee, Florida, and the school that my sister attended had bats in the belfry, and I mean thousands of them. Evenings, clouds would swarm out of there, and we used to play with them by throwing BBs and small pebbles up, and they'd kind of dive at them and stuff. Then we would go canoeing on this lake, and at dusk, lots of bats would come out and fly around us. I mean, we'd heard about the hair thing, but they would fly actually like between your arm and your face as you were paddling. And I thought they were, like, picking off the mosquitoes and stuff. But he said that, they're only the smaller bats eat mosquitoes. What were those guys doing?
All right. Good question.
Well, it's a very good question. There are more kinds of insects around water than just mosquitoes. I mean, there are all kinds of small insects that emerge from the surface of the water. They spend most of their lives beneath the water surface as larvae, and then they emerge. I mean, caddisflies are another example of mayflies. These are insects that are commonly associated with water. I just want to clarify something. This doesn't say that bats don't sometimes eat mosquitoes, and perhaps they're more likely to feed around individuals that are out canoeing. One of the things that mosquitoes are attracted to is carbon dioxide. And if you're canoeing and you're exhaling and breathing, there's going to be this sort of cloud of a carbon dioxide around you. And so this is what attracts the mosquitoes. And so it isn't to say that bats don't eat mosquitoes. It's just that they don't eat lots of them.
All right, Chip, thanks for calling. 1-800-989-8255. How hungry is an insect-eating bat? How many insects a night, or what can he eat or she eat? Trying to be politically correct here with a bat. Mm.
Well, Bill, do you want to take this one, or do you want me to take it?
Go for it, Tom.
okay. okay. Well,
I didn't think it was that hard a question.
No, it isn't. It isn't a hard question. I just was trying to share the mic.
Well, I wasn't asking either one of you in particular. Yeah, either, so
I know. Well, anyway, it depends on what the size of the insects they're eating. They can eat up to like 40. Well, again, depends on the size of the bat. But an average bat that let's say 10 to 12 grams, can eat its weight of night in insects during the energy-demanding period of lactation. And during that period of time, if they're eating just moths or mostly moths or maybe eating caddisflies, they could eat anywhere between 50 to 100 of these. If they're eating smaller insects, obviously they have to eat more of those in order to meet the demands and equal the size of the weight of their own body. But it varies. But they do, I would say on average, over the summer, each night, a bat would eat at least half of its weight in insects.
Wow. And you multiply that by a million bats.
And you multiply that by several million, and you're talking about several tons, literally metric tons of insects. Just to give you an example, in parts of South Central Texas, where there are a number of caves and other places where bats roost, like under bridges and so on, there have been estimates of upwards to 100 million bats living in that area during the summer. And we're talking about, if each bat eats even half of its weight of insects in a given night, we're talking about several metric tons of insects per night that these bats would be eating.
And
over a season, we're talking about several hundred metric tons of insects. So they play a very important role in controlling insect populations.
William Gannon, now you have these insects flying around, and you have the bats flying around. They're both moving at a pretty good speed. This echolocation must be really accurate to grab an insect out of the air in mid-flight.
Yeah, indeed it is. And again, as Tom's prefaced, a lot of this is that depends on which species you're talking about and the foraging behavior that it exhibits. But a typical silver-haired bat may be able to detect an insect 3 or 4 meters away and be able to narrow in on something as small as a gnat from that distance, which is a pretty good feat using just acoustics.
And those emissions, those sound waves we heard before, were those what they send out? Was that returning also, the echo coming back?
Yeah, actually what you heard was a converted file from Anabat into a wave file, so you could hear it. Just to, again, clarify one other earlier thing is that the Anabat records, and there's other detectors too. Anabat is a divide-by detector that records in real time, and you can record to it a tape or a laptop computer or another sort of storage device. And then through the software of Anabat itself, you can examine these call files and such, or convert them to these wave files that you heard. Mm-hmm. So what you're hearing and what you heard on the earlier before the break was a wave file of a call emitted by a silver-haired bat.
Okay, let's go to the phones. Laura in St. Paul. Hi, Laura.
I'm kind of wondering, we've got I see some bats coming out of our blue spruces, you know, in the evening sometimes here. We've just got tons of mosquitoes and moths and stuff flying around. And I kind of wish there was more of them around here. So what could I do to kind of help increase the population around here?
How do you attract bats to your
belfry? Yeah, how do you attract them to help you control your bug population?
Well, there are a number.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Bill.
Bill, you want to go on that one? Go ahead.
Well, I'll give it a start. And I mean, two ways. One is don't eliminate them. That'll always help. In other words, there's a lot of public education that needs to go on about the benefits of bats and their habits, and hopefully some of the information on this show will help towards that. But you can also do that yourself, and one effective way is erecting a bat house or a bat-friendly structure that bats, at least during their summer months, will hopefully find roost in and take up residence at your home.
Mm-hmm. And you don't want to disturb them when they're hibernating, right?
Absolutely not. It's interesting that one arousal caused during hibernation by people going into caves and are inadvertently disturbing them, one arousal is the equivalent to about 30 days in energy expended during hibernation. So So if they're aroused too often, they just won't have enough fat at the end of the season in order to survive and or arouse. Just make one comment about bat houses. I mean, bat houses have proven to be quite successful in different parts of the country, and they shouldn't be all alike. Just like when we build houses in Minnesota versus in Albuquerque, New Mexico, mm-hmm. Our house designs are quite different, and colors and so on. And so the shape and the color of the house can be very important in latitudinally and in different climates. So it's important to try to find out about different bat house designs. And Bat Conservation International, based in Austin, Texas, produces their material on their website that you can find out about more about building bat houses.
Thanks for calling, Laura.
Great, thanks.
Bye-bye. 1-800-989-8255. Rob in Michigan. Hi, Rob.
Hi. I'm an emergency physician, and we've always been taught, and I also teach, that bats are a big harbinger of rabies. And even if someone comes in contact with a bat, not even being bitten or scratched, that they are at risk. Can you speak to anything about that?
Thomas, you want to try that?
Sure. Well, I think having had a daughter go through medical school, know that there's very little training in the medical field about the real risks associated with bats. Certainly, bats do carry rabies. There's no doubt about it. And rabies is a deadly disease. However, the incidence of rabies in bats is actually quite small. Probably in the natural population in most species in North America is less than 0.5%. Now, that being said, you know, 0.5%, that means that somebody, if bitten by a bat that is carrying rabies, could die. And so anybody who is exposed by a bat bite certainly should receive rabies treatment with immunization. Biggest problem that I think has gotten out in the public is that just a bat flying over is also a risk, and this is absolutely incorrect. There was a study done back in the 1950s in caves in Texas where there was reported a non-bite contact with bats. Now, these are colonies that are high humidity, high temperature, and where there are millions of bats, and it's possible, and there have been certainly the virus has been identified in the saliva of bats, it's been identified in the urinary tract of bats, and it's postulated that that's how the non-bite contact occurred. But there's absolutely no reason, if there's a bat flying in around your house, and CDC, who communicates with the public about communicable diseases, has actually gone on record to say that there is no need to actually immunize or give somebody a post-exposure vaccine with that kind of an exposure. Really, yeah. Only in the case of a bat bite should one receive any kind of, or a suspected bat bite.
Mm. Rob, thanks for calling.
1-800-989-8255.
We're talking about bats this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Simple question. Happens to a lot of people. They come home one day and they find a bat fluttering around their living room. How do you get it out of the house? You don't want to hit it with a, you know, or kill it. What do you do?
Open the door. Open the door.
There you go.
Don't panic. Just open the door and it'll fly out. Or should you, what if it's just sitting on the wall? Will it sit on the wall if it's during the day and wait for the nighttime and then fly out? Or how do you handle that?
Well, actually, we get a lot of calls here in spring and in fall. This isn't a cop out yet. I'll get to the cop out in a minute. But for bats that will stop over in Albuquerque or somewhere here in New Mexico and on their way to somewhere else while they're during their spring and fall migrations. And oftentimes a bat will just light on a wall and stay there over the night, and we'll get calls, frankly, probably 3 or 4 times a day during some times of the season asking what to do. And I usually say, well, if it's there tomorrow, give me a call. And I never usually get that call back. Oftentimes bats that are moving from one area to another, again during migration times in the spring and fall, will just rest over somewhere and not find the appropriate roosting area away from humans. And in the case of a bat being in the house, there are chances that it could be sick, or it just could be disoriented for one reason or another.
It's interesting.
Is that the cop-out point you were talking about?
Yeah, I was going to let Tom now
well,
pick that up.
No, but I
got about a minute left, so go ahead.
Okay, no, what Bill said is absolutely correct. But oftentimes in the late summer, when young are just beginning to fly, they get lost sometimes. If they're maybe living in the attic and they get down into the living quarters, that's the more common thing. And I think the best solution, as Bill said, open the door at night, and if they're healthy, they'll leave. If they're sick, then, and they're hanging around day and night there, then you should call your, you know, local animal control officer.
Should you pick up a bat if you find it?
No. Actually, you should not. No one should pick up a bat unless they're trained to do so and or have been immunized against rabies. It's a risk that nobody should take.
All right.
Unless they're experienced.
Well, happy Halloween to both you gentlemen.
Well, thank you very much.
And we've run out of time. William Gannon is the Senior Collection Manager and Research Associate Professor the Museum of Southwestern Biology at the University of New Mexico in Albuquerque. Thomas Coons is a professor of biology and director of the Center for Ecology and Conservation Biology at Boston University. Thanks again for joining us this hour.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Kevin Wade is our technical director. Our audio engineers are Matt Galick and Paul Masiello in New York, and we had help from Tristan Klum in Albuquerque and Matt Odette in Boston. Greg Smith composed our theme music, and we had help today from NPR librarians Kim Oleski and Alphonse Vinn. If you have comments or questions, surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com or drop us a line at Talk of the Nation Science Friday, 1221 6th Avenue, 37th floor, New York, New York, 10020. And as always, you're welcome to surf over to our website where you'll find teaching curricula, free curricula for you from Science Friday's Kids Connection. Also, we have archives, real audio, listen to it and streaming, or take it with you on your audible.com player. Have a great and safe Halloween. I'm Ira Flater. We'll see you next week. Next week, we're going to be in Minneapolis at the Science Museum, so hopefully we'll see you then. Have a great weekend. I'm Ira Flater in New York.